the BBC World Service in association with ABC and All India Radio. This is Stumped.
Hello and welcome to Stumped, your intercontinental hit of news, features and debate from the quirky world of cricket. I'm Alison Mitchell in London, where, yes, sport is starting to return slowly but surely, and even our socialising is starting to pick up, and we're even allowed to have bubbles now. That's the new terminology. But welcome to our very own Stumped bubble here. It's great to see you all with me.
Hi, it's Jim Maxwell in Sydney, and life is really starting to kick on here. They're playing rugby league. Rugby union's not far away. And I'm at that stage of life where a birthday party keeps your spirits up. So I was at a friend's 70th yesterday. There were eight of us. Yes, glorious social isolation, eight people around a table with rain tumbling down outside. But, we blew a few candles out and had some fun, as you do if you have a lunch party that finishes when it's dark. So I hope you're having fun wherever you are, and the Charo is hitting a golf ball or swatting a tennis ball.
Yeah, except on Thursdays because of this lovely program that we're involved with. Yeah, I'm Charu Sharma for All India Radio in Bangalore once again, where we're awaiting the monsoon, which traditionally arrives around the early part of June and stays till virtually the end of September. So that's about a three-month period where a lot of outdoor sports, such as cricket, which are hampered because of a little bit of rain, are traditionally not held. So our season for cricket particularly is taking its own time to open up, and other sports too are lagging well behind. Not so socially, though, because people are moving around. I saw a couple of pictures in the paper about the malls opening up, but hardly any people there yet because there's been a fair amount of fear. But luckily, of course, sport is opening up in other countries such as yours, Alison. Good news.
Yes, we are very excited about that. And it feels like it's just around the corner, still a few weeks away. We celebrated the fact that international cricket is just around the corner last week. We even brought you some cricket from the island of Guernsey in the last show. Well, this week, we're in fact going to focus on racial equality in cricket. The West Indies men have just arrived in England, incidentally, ahead of their three test series due to start on the 8th of July by a secure venue with no spectators. But the team have arrived here against a backdrop of anti-racism protests, with thousands having taken to the streets in response to the killing of the black American George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis. Now, the Black Lives Matter movement is really shining a light on racial inequalities in all walks of life all over the world, and so we want to explore the state of play when it comes to cricket. Our first guest is, or very familiar to Stumped listeners, she is Director of Women's Cricket at Surrey, a World Cup winner in 2009, and she was the first black woman to play for England. Ebony Rainford-Brent, how are you?
Hi guys, thanks so much for having me, I really appreciate it. It's a crazy time in the world though right now, right?
It is. A disclaimer, Ebony and I are pretty good friends, so we've had some conversations over the last week or so, but just tell us and Jim Charo and our listeners how George Floyd's death and the aftermath has affected you.
Yeah, I've been pretty emotionally rocked, if I'm honest. I remember the morning waking up, and on your social media, I watched the short version of the video at first and burst into tears immediately. I've known for a long time the issues in the US around police brutality, and I've seen a number of videos. It's just off the back of Ahmaud Arbery, who'd been shot whilst just going for a jog. I see videos of young kids being punched in the face by police. And also here, I know the disparity. A lot of my friends growing up have been stopped and searched, and there's been police brutality. So it hit me very hard. I was in floods of tears for about 2 days consistently, speaking to a lot of my friends. And I would say that's not even just black friends were walled off different diversities. We were rocked so much. I've been out protesting. I know it's one of those ones where you sort of weigh up, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and some would say, is that responsible? And I guess for me and my values, racism for me is a pandemic and a virus that's been around for 400 years. The amount of black people have been killed through Atlantic slave trade, the amount of people disproportionately killed through the police system, how it affects our, livelihood and communities, which have been ravaged for a number of years. I was just so moved that I've been out at the protest. So, emotionally, and also I've just set up a fundraiser, which I just launched this morning with, some big names in the UK, Denise Lewis, Alex Scott, to really raise awareness, because it's something that needs to stop now, and it really filters through our society. Mm.
We'll come to cricket specifically in a moment, but broad question, society-wise, what do you hope that this period and the demonstrations, not least, will achieve?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because I think, you know, the number one thing is kind of building awareness, which is, you know, a number of us aren't aware how the society is broken down, and that a number of people are. So a simple example, CVs, two identical CVs gets tested all the time, go into a job. And if it has a name that sounds black or brown, you know, something like five or six times less likely to be looked at. So jobs are affected. So all these sort of things, once you start building awareness and companies start to realize how much bias plays into the decisions of our society, I think things will open up. So number one is awareness. You know, we're seeing brands come out that they need to have a look at their structures. We're seeing cricket and sport come out and support. So I think number one is awareness. Then two, it needs to be really woven into the process. I think a period of reflection. You know, let's be honest, there's going to be a number of people who don't agree with this. Maybe the All Lives Matter crew who are sort of saying, what about us or what about everybody? That's not so much the issue. This is not about saying other communities don't matter. It's about recognizing that one specific community consistently over history have been oppressed in a number of ways that plays out through whether it's police violence or lower. So awareness, number one. And I think that in itself is a number of years. You know, I know a lot of people are starting to educate, read themselves, watch documentaries and start to understand. I think that starts the spiral. And the final thing I'll say on this, if we feel something, if you watch a video of George Floyd and you feel uncomfortable about that, that's a good sign. I think it will help us make action. If you feel uncomfortable that in our country, there are no black players coming through our system, if you feel a motive about that, and then we'll do something. So for me, it's about connecting and making a difference.
So on cricket, Ebs, tell us your story of how you first got into the sport, because growing up as you did, a young black girl in London, cricket was predominantly, well, as it is now, predominantly white.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I grew up, like you say, South London, sort of Herne Hill, Brixton way, and cricket was not in our consciousness at all. I remember loving football because that's what, you know, lots of different communities played. And it was someone coming into my primary school when I was 10 years old. He was actually a Jamaican guy who was doing a sort of charity initiative to try and introduce cricket into state schools. I wasn't interested because I was like, what is this weird game? Like, I don't know anyone who plays this thing.
That despite the great West Indies team of the 80s.
That's the thing, isn't it? Like, unless, you know, my mum wasn't into cricket. Yeah. And unless you have that experience, it's just so alien, right? I hit one ball, got hooked, started playing street cricket with a very diverse group, black, white, Asian, Greeks, you know, the works, like out in Stockwell Park. So very rough games we were playing. And then there was one lady, this woman has changed my life. She's passed away now, but her name's Jenny Washdrack. She talent spotted me. We were playing like a little competition. They needed a girl. So I went down as the one girl. And she talent spotted me. And she was connected to a lot of the community initiatives and the Surrey Pathway. So it was her that brought me in. She realized, you know, financially it was quite tricky. My mum, a single parent of four kids, didn't have a car. So she used to drive me everywhere, club, county. She'd teach me how to knock in a bat. She got funds for me. And it was basically her that helped me into the system. Without her, I have to be honest, some of the challenges in the environment, I most probably would have fallen off because it was such a different world to what I was used to. But I'm grateful that she did, because it's changed my life.
And what were your experiences then once you were in cricket? Experiences of racism?
Definitely. Look, there's no doubt. I think from a young kid, it was interesting. So bearing in mind, I came from a diverse community where race was never an issue. As soon as I went into the cricket world, just people had lack of understanding because they didn't know any black people. So it was colours of questions. Do you wash your skin? You know, people would just start putting their hands in your hair. They'd tell you your food smells. You know, I remember I have a very long name, as you know, Ali, and people say, oh God, where you're from, I bet your mum doesn't know who your dad is. That's why you got so many names. So all these sort of things started to filter into my experience as a kid. You know, all those sort of things would happen. And if I'm honest, I don't think they were said maliciously, but they were ridiculously ignorant and they didn't understand. And that would grate at me. I didn't say anything because you're the only one. And then later on in my career, you know, comments from coaches, things like, I remember Obama when he got elected as president, the paper was slammed down in front of me and sort of said, I bet your lot are happy, meaning obviously your lot being black. I've been told once when I was asking a question about selection. We're not going to select you for this game because they don't like your sort up here. So look, I can tell you story after story after story, which I'm embarrassed myself that I never took it on, but I never felt I'd be supportive if I did speak up.
Well, that's an issue in itself, isn't it? And that would go for players as well, which I know is something we want to explore. I'll bring Jim and Charu in at this point, because I know they've both got burning questions for you as well.
Hello, Ebs. It's Jim in your favourite rainy city, Sydney. Yes. in the 80s and 90s, England had several black players in their men's team. They've only had three in the last decade, with Chris Jordan, Jofra Archer, and Michael Carberry. Why do you think this is the case?
Okay, so there's two things I want to pick you up on there, Jim. One, I think it's really important we differentiate British-born black players, so players who've come through our system, and those who learnt their trade. Because actually, if you start to look at how many actually came through our structure, the numbers are a lot lower. So why we've never really had a pathway into the inner cities. I think the game in the UK is still predominantly based on the pathways from the independent schools. And by that nature, it's just exclusive. You know, it might not necessarily be that anyone's specifically cutting somebody out, but if you are not going to that school and you're not in the system, and then you don't make it into the county structure. So for me, I think, you know, that's been the issue, that cricket hasn't adapted like other sports. You look at football, rugby, athletics here, they have pathways from the inner city to the outer regions. You can get into the game from any part of the country. But I think cricket, we're still so independent school heavy that it means that it naturally excludes parts of the community. So again, I'll throw that to you. You know, you most probably would have seen an England team once with five players. I think that would have been sort of Roland Butcher days back in the, possibly in the 80s. So you think of that having an England team, but the question I would ask is how many learnt their real trade through the UK system, and the numbers are really low.
So things are changing, hopefully, and it's getting more opportunity for people. And so you need to tell us about what's happening where you are at Surrey in overseeing a scheme to get more black kids into cricket.
Yeah, really interesting scheme. So we were looking at the numbers and realising that it's declining for the black population. But at Surrey, in Lambeth, where the Oval is, 42% of the kids, so just under half of the kids, sort of up to 19 years age group, are from a black community. So we realised we're sat in mostly one of the most dense parts of the UK in terms of population. So we just put a marketing thing out to say we're going to hold some trials. If you've got a bit of talent, a bit like an X Factor talent, come along. And we had about 100 kids sign up, boys and girls, and we were only going to take 16 places for the academy, and we upped it to 26, I believe, because there was so much talent, especially in the older age group. We've seen some players that we think could really make it into the pathway. So as soon as COVID's over, because unfortunately they're not in training because of this situation, but I'm seeing there's a pathway back, we'll be getting them in training and putting them through their paces. And, you know, you never know. We continue this for the next 5 years. You know, you could have one in county cricket, possibly from the older age group in the next, you know, who knows, in the next couple of years, because there's a couple that have that potential. So, you know, if we get it right at Surrey, I think we can roll this out in cities and counties where there's more, Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester, you know, around the country. So we want to try and just build a model that will excite people, open up pathways, and then start to build more clubs and support and pathways in the local community for the grassroots programs.
I know Charu wants to come in, but just one thing, Ebony, what you were saying before about calling out incidences of racism or comments. I'm imagining you've seen and read what Michael Carberry has had to say about the game, that racism is rife in cricket. And he believes that his attempt to challenge a coach on a discriminatory comment led to the beginning of the end of his career at that particular club. What would make it easier for people to call out? And that responsibility isn't just on the person who is on the receiving end of that comment, is it?
Yeah, so a few things I'll just add as well. During my journey, when I was struggling with some of the issues in the environment, Michael Carberry was a mentor for me. He actually did a lot of coaching. He would talk to me about these issues, and he was always vocal and I was always quiet, and I never knew which were the right approach. I don't think any worked as such. But what's happening with this global awareness around this issue now is that I think people realize things can't go unchecked. I feel, for example, more empowered based on the movement that if something was to happen now, it's okay to speak up because it's wrong and the world now knows it's wrong, which I don't think, you know, I listened to Michael Carberry's interview and he spoke very candidly. I was quite impressed actually with how much he put out there. I think that the difference now is that one, it's not, this is, it sounds really bad, but not just the black person who knows it's wrong now. I think the wider community might step in and have something to say. And that's really important. I think for this to change, for this to really change, it's not the black person making the call and, you know, it's actually the whole wider community, the whole melting pot needs to come together and say, look, we don't accept discrimination of any sort, whether it's a female, whether it's colour, and you need your friends to stand up. And I think this is what this situation will force anyway.
Hi, Ebony. This is Charu Sharma from Bangalore for All India Radio. Good to be speaking to you again. And good luck with all your initiatives that you've just mentioned. You also mentioned a very important point about focusing on the UK born and bred scenario rather than people from outside. So I know that Jofra Archer is not from the local system, but do you think as a current hero, there's a fair amount of responsibility as a role model for Jofra to perhaps take up the whole cause? Or is that too much for one person and he might wilt under the pressure?
That's a really good question. First of all, good to see you again, Charu. First of all, a couple of things. I don't think we would have got the ACE program moving without Jofra Archer, because we know that we've now got somebody who's so good that the next 10 years he's going to be in the team, assuming he stays fit and in good order. So we've got a role model, a beacon for the kids to look up to. We've also contacted him when we were talking about the ACE, and he was like, he's happy to support. You know, if he can come down and speak to the kids. He knows. I think one thing that's great about his character, he's naturally just himself, but I think he cares about this sort of thing. I don't want it to distract him and feel like this weight of pressure that, you know, it's he has to do that. He just needs to keep doing what he's doing, and we will leverage his energy, you know, as counties or as community groups or sport. We can talk to the kids about, look at that guy. And that's all we really want from him. I know he popped to the protest sort of on his Instagram as well. So I know that it hits his heart. So I don't want players like him or Chris Jordan to feel like they have to overly do anything. But for us, the longer they're successful, the longer they're there, we can really use that energy behind them.
Yeah, although a part of me does wish that he can also play along this campaign. But I see what you mean, that, you know, it's more important for him to carry on playing the cricketing hero. Alison mentioned some time back that, of course, the West Indies are in England now for the three test series. And perhaps we can spare a minute to listen to their captain, Jason Holder, who had a few things to say about the Black Lives Matter campaign.
This is a time for people to educate themselves firstly. You know, I think I've seen so many different things on social media over the last couple weeks. And people have said some sensible things, in my opinion. People have said some outrageous things. People have definitely spoken with true emotion. And for me, my piece of learning from this entire thing is that the only way you can have a positive contribution on it is if you educate yourself firstly. Have facts. I think is a perfect opportunity, not only for Black people, you know, but for the world again, to educate themselves on the whole spectrum of race. And then, maybe then, you know, we can all see what's in front of us clear and make strides on making positive solutions, you know. And then you must find ways to unite and make a massive force pushing in one direction.
Well, that's Jason Holder. And Ebony, with everything that's going on, is there a great opportunity here to showcase the West Indies and to showcase the skills of Black cricketers from there and other parts of the world to hopefully inspire and educate some of the youngsters from different backgrounds in England to not feel oppressed?
Yeah, I think you should know, it's really interesting, isn't it? Whether it's a fate thing that this tour is at this time, you know, who knew that we'd be in the middle of a pandemic and we'd be in the middle of this movement. So West Indies coming here, first of all, you've got to give credit to them for traveling. I'm not sure, you know, other countries would necessarily do it coming to the country with the highest numbers. But you're right, I think during this series, there's a chance for a narrative to be told, which brings the struggle at times and the celebrations of the history. You think about the, you know, the West Indies team, and, you know, you watch Fire in Babylon. I've been speaking to Michael Holding quite a bit about you know, the history of the game and what those that generation did. Fair enough, this generation isn't quite the standard of that one, but I think them being here, Jason Holder speaking up with power, you know, maybe some of the England players will discuss it. The narrative over this summer could be really good. Like he said, I agree with him. The number one thing is education. Once people start to understand and see the issues and sort of get that lens on, then we all move together, right? So let's hope this summer is a real opportunity for the team and England team to kind of, in the background of the tour, talk about some of these important issues.
And that sense of pausing and stepping back. We've seen statues being removed in that debate around the UK. The MCC has become the first sporting body to reassess their works of art. And in fact, they have removed from public display their first secretary. The first secretary of the MCC was a slave owner. So the MCC are already taking steps, but just stepping back and looking and assessing, which is all important. Stay with us, Ebony, because I want to talk about another specific story that's come to light this week in relation to race. So Darren Sammy, the former West Indies captain, took to social media to express his anger when he found out that his nickname in the Indian Premier League referred to the colour of his skin. Now, Sammy was part of the Sunrisers Hyderabad dressing room in the IPL in 2013 and 2014, and he asked his former teammates if they could explain themselves.
Instantly, I remember when I played for Sunrisers Hyderabad in 2013 and 2014, I was being called the exact same word that he described that was degrading to us black people. So I instantly got very angry about it, knowing now what that word meant. I will be messaging those people. You guys know who you are. And I must admit, at the time in which I was being called that, I actually did not know what it meant. I thought it meant strong stallion or whatever it is. And I saw no problems with it because I was ignorant to the fact that I did not know what it meant. I assumed it meant something else that was uplifting. But every time I was called it, it was me and to Sarah Pereira, there was always laughter in the moment. So me being a team man, I thought, hey, teammates are happy, it must be something funny. But you could understand my frustration and my anger when it was pointed out to me that it wasn't funny at all. It was degrading.
I don't know about you, I found that a really powerful video. He was talking directly to the camera. He was very calm, very composed, but you could see the hurt in his eyes. Charu, let me come to you first on this one, because that word that Sammy was referring to has been widely reported as Kalu. And indeed, one of the Indian papers dug out a photograph that was posted by Ishant Sharma that labelled Sammy with that when he was his teammate at Sunrisers. So what does it mean? Is it a racist term?
Oh, Alison, well, you know, now we're opening up a bit of a long discussion here, once again, the possibility of. But let me try and offer Darren Sammy a bit of a balm here by suggesting and by confessing that even I, from a very early age, coming from the north of India and being a lot darker than the average North Indian, have been called Kalu all the time. So all I can say is that it has always, in India, been taken as a literal terminology of being dark, Kalu as in color, as in dark, and has little or no derogatory reference ever. Now, people from the north of India are generally a lot lighter, and this is the situation in a multi-skinned or multicultural society. So I'm no expert here, but I would like to suggest that people from the south of India, closer to the equator, hotter climes, have been generally of darker skin. And there has been a lot of color references, but never has it been suggested that just because people were darker, they achieved less. There have been all manners of high achievers in just about every field from the south of India. So the term really is very literal in our part of the world. Now, I realize that it has derogatory connotations elsewhere, but, you know, it's a sort of a cultural thing then here. And I would like to suggest to Darren that it's just a color reference, quite the same vein as many people in our part of the world would call people with lighter skin Gora, which is white. without ascribing any other kind of meaning to that term, just lighter skin or darker skin. And I'm not absolving anybody here of any kind of blame that may arise because of, you know, the potential of making some fun because of skin color. It's also obviously not done. We can talk about that later. But I would like to suggest that in multicultural societies, multi-skin societies, it is not a derogatory term in general.
Well, we'll pick up on that, but let's hear again from Darren Sammy, because since he released that Instagram video, he has spoken to teammates, and he had this then to say to our colleagues at the BBC Asian Network.
I am in no way, shape or form trying to call or pinpoint anybody. The fact that I understand that that word that I've been called can be described as a degrading, condescending type of word. I'm saying, whether you said it out of love at that time, it's a word that shouldn't be used because it could be described as offensive to people of color. And I think that's my biggest takeaway from that, educating people. You know, I still have enough love for these guys. And you mentioned Ishan Sharma. Ishan Sharma has a poster of me and him from Champions Trophy, my hand over his shoulder, and I have signed it, and I've said, brothers for life. That's the relationship. So yes, the conversation to expose it or talk about it, it was a difficult one, but it is one that is needed.
If you looked at Sammy's original Instagram video, Cherry, there was so many hundreds and hundreds of comments beneath it, many from Indian cricket fans who had varying views even within the country. One Indian fan, for example, saying, when it comes to other people like you calling you that, you don't mind it. But when it comes from a stranger or someone who isn't like you, that's when it feels degrading. So there are so many layers of nuance around it.
Well, yeah, there are all sorts of subtleties. Like I said, this is opening up a very, very large discussion. But I would like to suggest once again that, you know, it may seem derogatory, but it's not. It's just a term of sometimes even endearment. You know, I have lots of friends who are called Kalu, and I still call them Kalu, and they're happy to be called Kalu. In fact, one of my other schoolmates, his younger brother is not quite as dark, but he's called Chota Kalu, as in small Kalu. So, you know, these things in India are less likely to be taken seriously, but I do realize that there are many other different cultures in the world. And if there's a certain culture, which is primarily white, and if any reference to darker colors is openly derogatory, then we have to deal with it. And even in India, I'm not, like I said, you know, condoning the usage of the word at all. And perhaps with more education, and that's certainly happening now, the references are reducing. But it's just a color reference in India, and it should not be taken in any negative sense. I'd like to say that to Darren Sammy once again, because many people from within India who are also darker are called the same term, more as an endearment. But I mean, I realize that people who are called dark don't exactly enjoy it. So, you know, in India, we've learned to live with it because we are very multi-skinned, multicultural. But in other cultures, I can understand the pain.
Well, that's having some understanding. Yeah, it's having some understanding of the people you're communicating with. But Ebony, is it ever acceptable to use nicknames that refer to the colour of skin?
So the one thing that stood out for me in this interview is Darren Sammy just said he still has a lot of love for his players. And I think this is important that we realise it's not about pointing fingers. You know, I've mostly said plenty of offensive stuff to friends. I guess this is where we start to understand each other and cultural differences. I know, for example, I've got a lot of friends from sort of Bengal, and when I go and have with the family, I've learned not to use my knife and fork, and I've gotten involved with my eating with my hands. And you know, you learn these sort of cultural things by you know, different things around religion, race, gender. You know, there's words that are now not appropriate that were before. So I think the thing for me around this whole point is not to take anybody down. You know, we're all human and we're going to make mistakes. But I think it's important that Darren Sammy, for example, speaks out. So people will know in India when he goes there to play in the IPL, look, this is not right. In my culture, this is very offensive. And as long as his teammates go, look, apologise, I realise that's not right, let's change the culture so it works for everybody. You know, it is the same could happen here. If we have the 100 next summer, they're going to be people from different cultures. So it's not, I think that's the one thing I want to just say. You know, many of the people who've made racist comments to me in the past and you know, even more recently at times, I still have a lot of love for them. And now it's just about us having that conversation. If I say something inappropriate, I got called up the other day about a term which I didn't realize actually linked to homophobia. I didn't know that. I was completely unaware, but I just got told, look, this is not acceptable and I won't use it. So for me, that this is what this is about. It's about education. It's about understanding and us working together.
Jim, does it surprise you that actually with the number of international dressing rooms that there are these days, that cricket does seem a little bit slow to be, I suppose, learning about each other's culture? You know, there's no more mixed dressing rooms than you have at the Indian Premier League, at the Caribbean Premier League, in the Big Bash, in the 100 next year.
Well, that's where the IPL has been so important to the game. I think it's diffused a lot of these tensions and perhaps words that are inappropriate that weren't seen as such by those that use them amongst their teammates, but realised it, as Darren Sammy said, it's probably offensive depending on where you come from. So this sort of globalisation of cricket through T20 to a large extent in recent times has been important to the education and understanding of people and the way they should behave. And we're all of us more aware, I think, every time something occurs, unfortunately, as it has in the United States, that we need to take care with the words we choose to talk about situations. And that was interesting to hear Ebony talk about homophobia, which is another very sensitive area at the moment, given the way our society is changing. So we can't be totally pure, but we do need to have more awareness.
Yeah, Alison, I'd just like to add a little bit about the IPL that Jim mentioned. And there's no doubt in my mind that because of the friendships forged in the IPL, different nationalities and different teams, there's a huge level of improvement in the understanding. And the contests between countries now are no longer colored by culture or any kind of economics or anything else. They become much more cricketing contests. And there's no other angst or far less angst involved about competing with other nations, only because there's been so much more understanding about how other people behave and live and talk and just a deeper understanding of the subtleties involved, even though we're all the same people.
Yeah, they're all very good points. Ebony, thank you so much for joining us on the show and with your valuable contribution. And we are all in need of keeping talking, keeping educating amongst each other. So thanks for your time and sharing your story today.
Yeah, and always great to see you guys, so thank you.
That's Ebony Rainford-Brent. Well, remember, you can have your say on any of the topics that we discuss here on Stumped. We're at BBCWS Sport using the hashtag BBCStumped, and you can download our podcast every week from your favourite podcast app. Last week, we took you to Guernsey, the COVID-free British Channel Island, where our favourite bat and ball game is back underway.
You keep hearing this expression, and I suppose a lot of sports can kind of cash in on it at the moment here for however long it is, week, 2 weeks, a month, you know, first in the British Isles, isn't it? First cricket match in the British Isles this summer, which is pretty special.
From the BBC World Service, this is Stumped on ABC and All India Radio.
OK, well, to round off our special show on race issues in cricket, we're going to bring you the story of a man who claims that his cricketing dreams were dashed because of the colour of his skin. Aboriginal Australian John Maguire is the highest run scorer in the history of Western Australian grade cricket, yet he never played a single game for the state team. Although regularly appearing to be on the cusp of selection in the 1980s, the cherished baggy gold cap of WA never came his way.
Look, it was a really unfortunate situation, but the history for Aboriginal cricket in Australia generally is a very healthy one, in that Aboriginal cricketers and Aboriginal people played cricket long before they encroached on the football field, either the rugby codes or the Australian rules competition. So cricket teams were set up in missions, if you like, by some of the early settlers, and I'm talking the mid-1800s.
There was a commemorative tour recently, wasn't there? 2018 Cricket Australia sent a couple of Indigenous 11s over
to commemorate
one of the first.
Yeah. it was a men's team and a women's team. And of course, Dan Christian was in the men's team, and Ashley Gardner, who's a national player with the women's team, was in that team as well. So, look, we've got great representation now, but having said that, we don't embrace the Aboriginal cricketers like the football codes have done. And the opportunities have been very limited. And indeed, you know, my own personal story is one of disappointment in that there was this covert race or racial sort of undertones that sort of excluded you. And even though, you know, I mean, I was getting messages like, "Oh, John, you know, you're one big score away from selection." And that would happen, and then there'd be the goalpost would change, and there'd be another reason for non-selection. And I can remember we're rolling up to state cricket training, and you know, as an opening batsman, I expected that I would bat fairly early in the afternoon or evening, or be certainly in the afternoon, against the best bowlers. But, you know, it'd be almost dark, and the coach would say, "Oh, John, put the pads on." And Jeff Marsh and Mike Valletta and some of those guys would be bowling at me. And it's like, hang on, how can I develop my game against non-bowlers? Mm. Or why am I batting it this late in the afternoon, evening, when as an opening batsman, you know, I expect and I should be batting fairly early in the training session against the best bowlers.
Was there ever outright either abuse or discrimination that you experienced, sort of verbally, for example?
Yeah, there was always the racist comments, and, you know, being called black and laced with expletives and derogatory comments about the colour of my skin. But there wasn't anything from the state selectors or from the WACA as such, as the governing body of the game here in Perth. Mm. So, you know, it was there was nothing that was tangible or evident, but the underlying view was that you know, we're not going to play this bloke. It doesn't matter how many runs he makes.
Mm. Daryl Foster was WA coach, wasn't he, in that era? And he was quoted, yes, in 2017 at the age of 79, saying that you were a very fine player, quotes, "who had no technical deficiencies but was born in the wrong era." But tell us about a state's trial match when you believed that you had done enough.
Yes, look, it was an interesting trial match, 85, 86, I think it was. And it was a state trial match. We were told before the game had started, we were told that we would be selected on performance in a train-on squad. It was a long weekend, and the train-on squad would train on the Monday, but we would be selected on performance in this particular game. So it was a Saturday-Sunday fixture. I opened the batting with Graham Wood, who, you know, the audience out there will know who Graham mm-hmm. Wood is, as the, you know, a marvellous cricketer. And he and I actually came through State Schoolboys representing WA and opened the batting together during that very early period of under-19s cricket. But we went out to bat, and having been told that we would be selected in a train-on squad to train on the long weekend, the Monday. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about that specifically, but I started in reasonable form and was playing fairly well against a very competent bowling attack. Chris Matthews, Bruce Reid, Australian players, Ken McClay, who played a few games for Australia as well, and Tom Hogan came on as the spinner. So you're talking about all Australian attack. I cruised, I suppose, to a fairly comfortable 50. And at the drinks break, the state selectors came over, tapped me on the shoulder and said, oh, John, you can retire now. And my immediate reaction was, oh, terrific, OK, they've seen enough, they're happy with my form. And I expected that I would be part of this train-on squad. So the game plays out. The next day, the other team bats, our turn in the field. At the end of play on the Sunday, I'm expecting to hear the squad announced for the training the next day, and nothing happened. So I'm getting changed and about to walk out the door, and Peter Clough, who was played for WA as well and for Tasmania, I said, "See you at training on Wednesday, Cloughy." He said, "See you at training tomorrow." I said, "What's happening tomorrow?" And I'd just momentarily forgotten about this this train-on squad. He said, "No, I'll see you tomorrow." I said, "Why? What's happening tomorrow?" He said, "Haven't you been asked to participate in this train-on squad?" And I said, "No." I said, "Aren't they going to announce it?" He said, No. "They've told players individually." He said, "Haven't you been asked?" And I said, "No, I haven't."
And you're never given any explanation, or at least a satisfactory explanation?
No.
We're more than 30 years on now. With your closeness to cricket now, do you think that racism is still an issue at state and national level?
Oh, look, it still exists, absolutely. And the reason I say that with such emphasis is that 3-4 years ago, there was a young lad, Aboriginal lad, super player, very good player. He won the Ollie Cooley Medal, which is like the fairest and best player in the competition that year. Automatically, the WACA would award a state contract to the winner of that award. Before, as he was walking off the stage after accepting the award, he was told by a WACA official that he would not be given a state contract because they'd allotted all their allotments to players, so he wouldn't be getting one.
And you didn't believe that as a reason?
Oh, no, absolutely not. No, and so that tells me that nothing has changed in terms of the racist view that cricket in Australia, and particularly here in Perth, has of Aboriginal players. There's no pathway. There's no support.
Does the Impaja Cup provide a pathway?
No, it's a shame. And I you know, people might think, oh, well, you know, I'm bitter about non-selection. Sure, it was disappointing. Absolutely. But there's what I'm disappointed about is that nothing's changed in terms of including Aboriginal cricketers. Now, you don't want an easy run and given an opportunity if you haven't deserved to be selected. Mm. But when there is fairly glaring evidence that you know, you've competed and you've played and you've achieved as much as what other players who have been selected in the game has done, then you've got to ask yourself, what is the difference? Why is there this disparity? You know, I've had hundreds, thousands of Aboriginal people come to me and say, you know why you didn't play state cricket for Western Australia? And I deliberately say, look, I'm not sure, but what's your view? And emphatically they say, because you're Aboriginal, because you're black.
Well, that is Aboriginal Australian John Maguire. Now, I do have a statement from the Western Australian Cricket Association. They say that the current WACA administration is unable to comment on selection decisions from last century. However, we have a long history of involvement of Aboriginal people in cricket here in WA and are fully committed to continuing to grow Aboriginal participation and pathways with guidance from the WA Aboriginal Cricket Advisory Committee. We have a role at the WACA dedicated to developing and expanding existing programs that engage with local schools and Aboriginal communities. Over time, these programs will also ensure that talented Aboriginal players will remain in the game longer and become role models to inspire the next generation of Aboriginal players. Jim, let me bring you in on this one. In particular, why so few Aboriginal cricketers in the system coming through to the professional game in Australia as opposed to, say, you know, football and the rugby codes?
Well, there's a number of reasons for it. You'd have to say, just naturally, the Indigenous Australians are more attracted to fast-moving sports like rugby, rugby league, Aussie rules, athletics, Cathy Freeman, a classic example. And there haven't been too many cricketers produced for one reason or another by the system, even though Cricketer Australia are doing their darndest. And you heard John Maguire talk there about the Imparja Cup to try and find more players with that background. And that seems to be something of a case perhaps in women's cricket, less so in men's. You just do not see many Aboriginal cricketers around the place, or Indigenous is the word, of course. But that's not to say there aren't a lot of people from other backgrounds, particularly from Asia, who are making their way in Australian cricket. But I've got to be careful what I say here. But Charlie King is one of our well-known correspondents in ABC Sport, who is an Indigenous Australian, who's done a power of work with Aboriginal people. And I said to him one day when I was in Darwin, I said, why is it that in this state in particular, your Northern Territory team doesn't have more Indigenous people in it? He says one of the main reasons is that cricket is played in whites, and that is not respected by a lot of Indigenous Australians. That's what he really reckoned was an underscore to the problem that people had from an Indigenous background in identifying with and wanting to play cricket. But I think, as I said before, just more naturally, they're attracted to the fast-moving sports. And that's why you see so many good Indigenous sports people playing Aussie rules, rugby league and rugby union, and getting involved in athletics. But there it is. Take it for what it's worth. Let's hope that people like Ashley Gardner will become role models in this current era for others with Indigenous backgrounds to want to play cricket.
Charu, it's got to be about pathways, but needing some visibility. Role models are one element of it, but it's sort of got to start with attracting the kids at the community level.
Yeah, well, the world of cricket, like the world of just about any other sport, is all about role models. And the point is, how does one get to being a role model by being one of the better players in the country or in the world? Now, in many sports, people of various colors have made it right to the top and have become role models. And similarly in cricket, I mean, those who may be dark or not or of light skin, you know, from the sport, we can expect a fair amount through the administration and the players in terms of education. But what becomes difficult is, you know, at the skin deep level, it's possible to manage that. But, you know, 7.5 billion people on Earth, how do we manage just about everybody? So references will keep happening. And I obviously don't have all the answers, but to a certain extent, we also have to understand the differences of the references made. Are they derogatory in terms of lack of performance, or are they just a color reference? So maybe there ought to be a bit of a divide there as well. But there's no doubt that, at least just staying with the world of cricket, we can make a much bigger difference by educating all the cricketers at every possible stage to ensure that they become ambassadors of this enormous equality that we're looking for. And that can be achieved. And even through the administration, that can be achieved. But is it going to be more difficult for youngsters of a certain color to make it to certain national teams? Well, it's up to the role models, the one or two, who have a very tough journey, Ebony Rainford Brent earlier, a very tough journey, to then inspire. And I think also, in a sense, offer a balm to everybody else, saying that there may be more obstacles, but listen, we can overcome them. And once we do, then, you know, there's much more in this world. So no easy answer here, but I think the world of cricket can certainly contribute by being leaders in ensuring that such obvious references are looked down upon and eradicated by just educating everybody else they're in touch with.
Role models to inspire, but others, everyone around, to help facilitate educating ourselves and those around us, understanding. Let's hope that cricket can do its part in moving this world forward. Well, that is all we've got time for on this week's Stumped. So I'll say thank you to Jim Maxwell and Cherry Sharma, and of course our guests, and thanks to all of you for listening. Make sure you join us again next week for more Stumped. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
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 Stumped is a BBC Sport production for the BBC World Service in association with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and All India Radio.